the Business on RTE Radio 1 with Bank of Ireland. As Ireland's enterprise bank, we're lending to over 500 businesses and farmers every week.
Hello again, you're listening to The Business. You can contact us by text to 51551, by phone to 1850 715150, email thebusiness@rte.ie or tweet to @thebusinessrte. It may be the dream of some of you to own your own island, and that's exactly what my next guest managed to do. In 2003, businessman Nadeem Sadek outbid Ronan Keating to buy an island in Clew Bay called Inishturk Beg. But the dream has since come to a shuddering halt. Nadeem joins us now. Nadeem, we'll talk to you about the island shortly, but first, your relationship with Ireland goes way back.
Well, I think it starts with my DNA. My mother's from Limerick, so I'm genetically, physically half Irish, the other half is Egyptian. And from my earliest memories, we travelled back to Ireland for holidays. My father worked for the World Health Organization, so we were based in Africa and Asia and the Caribbean and all over the place. So I was quite a global child. But all my holidays were spent coming back to Ireland and mainly in Limerick. And that was the beginning of my anchoring in the country, if you like.
How did Ireland strike you back in those days compared to the places that you had been living in and visiting?
Well, I absolutely loved my childhood. I'd lived in Nigeria and Ghana and Kenya and Malaysia, Indonesia, Barbados. I mean, they're all, you know, amazing countries to be brought up in. And so I wouldn't want to, by making a contrast with Ireland, suggest that they were in any way inferior. But what Ireland did strike me as was a place of red apples and running around on bicycles on paved roads and, you know, kids playing on estates, climbing over walls and kicking balls to each other and learning about conquerors and things. It was a fantastic, almost Enid Blyton-esque dream coming true for me. I loved it.
So you got a chance then to move and live in Ireland. You were educated, secondary school and university here.
That's right. When I was at school in Malaysia, it was noticed that some of my young classmates were going to the petrol station opposite school during their break times and were giving away favours and receiving favours, and it was thought to be not the best environment for me to live in, and I was therefore shipped off to St. Columbus College in Rathfarnham, where there wasn't a lot of favour given one way or the other.
So you went on to Trinity College and studied psychology, and the world of business then beckoned. A lot of people who study psychology wouldn't find themselves going into marketing or business, but you did.
Yes, it was accidental, and you know, I think a lot of our paths in life are accidental. I've been very lucky with many of my paths, but I mean, I was rather indolent in university. I didn't do very much, and Susan Reardon, one of my best friends in college, did most of my work for me, and I have to thank her for it. But I did write the name for my thesis, which was Psychology for Sale, and that name alone, I think, led me to have job offers from a number of people because they thought that I had some inside track on how to market things better. Actually, I just had three words that I'd assembled into a neat little line.
Which is a good piece of marketing in itself.
It was accidental, but it did work.
So you ended up then going into the realm of marketing. You moved to London for a big job there and then set up your own business.
Yeah, I started my career at Lansdowne Market Research in Dublin, and they kindly sent me on a course to the UK. The convener of the course liked the look of me and headhunted me, as they used to say, to the UK. And I have to say, with some reluctance, I came because I was very happy in Dublin. But I went to London and stayed with her, became a director and partner in that business. And then for a number of reasons, eventually set up my own business in 1993, a company called Sadek Weinberg Research with Rebecca Weinberg, another fabulous woman in my life. And she and I accidentally grew the business to be the biggest in the UK by 2000, and by 2003 it was the biggest of its type in the world, and I sold it to WPP.
Did you make a lot of money when you sold it? A few million?
Yeah, you know, I made a small fortune, and I always appreciate that reality. I didn't come with a silver spoon into my mouth, into the world, and So anything that I get, I appreciate. And it's allowed me the choice of what I did next. And I'm grateful for that.
Along the way, you had purchased Inishturk Beg, an island in Clew Bay. Why did you buy it? And was it always your intention to do something special with it?
My wife is Irish, and our children are therefore three quarters Irish and a quarter Egyptian, and we largely live in London. And we didn't really ever think about having a second home. We were very happy with our house and our home, and we went on holidays. So it had never occurred to us to have another kind of centre of life. But we did appreciate that the children were, you know, as I said, sort of mixed race, if you like. I mean, it's funny that in Ireland we often say mixed marriage and we mean Catholic and Protestant when the rest of the world sees it in rather more profound terms. But the kids needed some sort of identity, we felt. And Mayo is where my wife's family came from. And I went to Clew Bay and we stayed in a friend's barn for a couple of summers, and I loved it. I loved the rain and I loved having to stay indoors during the summer. And I was really enchanted by it. So I was getting on a plane to Tokyo one day, and my wife rang me and said, there's half an island for sale. I said, fantastic, get some details. And when I landed in Tokyo, she updated me that the whole island was for sale, and I thought that we should buy it, you know. And it was just one of those, I know it sounds crazy, you know, but it was an impulsive act, knowing that this was a place of extraordinary beauty. That's the way the acquisition of the island began. And then we didn't really have great plans for it. I remember setting an initial budget for its development. But if anybody's thinking of doing a marine development, make sure your pockets have got about four times more in them than you think you're going to need, because everything is quadruple handling, and it's an extraordinarily difficult thing to do, to develop an offshore island.
So you began really transforming this island then into very much a dream place for you, but it was also going to be a business. What did you want to do?
Well, initially it was simply a recreational place. I always thought of it as a giant playground, and, you know, everything was just fantastic. So all of that happened first, and kind of running in parallel with this, as I mentioned, I'd sold my business to WPP, and as I was about to head for the hills, they asked me to help run Research International, which is one of their prime research networks, which was in 52 countries in the world. So I thought, you know, that's too good an opportunity to pass up, and I did it. But I quickly realized that I had too much energy. I felt still too creative. I was having too much fun with the idea of Inishturk Beg for me to kind of sit in a corporate job for another 20 years and play my days out. So I thought, actually, why don't I start a brand? Why don't I start practicing what I've preached to all my clients for so long and show them how it's done, you know? And Inishturk Beg was the most fantastic, authentic provenance for a brand. And I set about building that.
Now, you also had to physically build an infrastructure there. You know, you built a beautiful house, gorgeous swimming pool. You had to get electricity there, all of the concrete. How did you get all of that over to the island?
We started on little boats, and all the lads who came out to work every day arrived with their sandwiches wet and their trousers in a mess. And I thought, well, this won't do. I better get a bigger boat. And so, you know, and each step was taken like that, that as we needed things, we then imagined how we might do it. And eventually I had to hire a ship for a year, and that brought all our heavy supplies. And we actually had the biggest mobile crane in Ireland on the island for a while, which came up from Cork somehow. I've no idea how.
It must have been devouring a lot of money at this stage.
It was an expensive project. It was an expensive project. But the material investment was more than rewarded by the spiritual benefit. So we just went with it, really.
This would have been very much the height of the boom period as well. And you probably felt, you know, at some point, not only were you going to get an enormous amount personally out of this project, but it would generate financial returns as well.
Yes, and in fact, I bought the island in 2003, started really investing it in 2004. The first years were gentle enough because I was busy running other things and working at Research International until 2008.
You bought
it
it for about €1 million, is that right?
Yeah, a bit more than that,
a bit
but
more.
Yeah, about that. And I suppose actually from 2008 to 2010, so very much knowing that I was in a global crisis, that was the period of the biggest investment. That's when the electricity and water came under the sea, and that's when we built roads and sewage systems and put in all-weather jetties and, you know, things like that. And the boats got bigger and the plans got rather more glorious. But it was all done in full sight of the global crisis.
Were you nervous about that at the time?
Of course I was anxious. You know, none of us could foresee how bad the crisis would be, but it was evident that it was going to be fairly stern, and, you know, frugality and prudence were probably the things to be looking after at that time. But I had a good relationship with a bank to whom I had given a lot of money over the years and who said that they would back me in this period of investment before return. And I was certain that the brand that we were creating would be a really remunerative one.
And then things started to go wrong in the wider economic environment, and the bank began to change its tune.
Yeah, I have to say it was really the bank changing its tune rather than the wider economic environment changing, because that was already, as I've mentioned, you know, changed. I knew that I was building something in bad times, but I'd done that several times before. You know, I often think recessions is the best time. If you can last a recession and become fit and lean during that period, then when the boom times come, you're really ready to take it. So it wasn't an unfamiliar situation. The reality is that the bank had a change in their global strategy regarding the euro. They didn't like facilities which were underpinned by euro-denominated assets. They hated them more if they were resident in a delinquent market like Ireland was deemed to be, similar to Greece and Portugal. And so it was clearly decided that an exit from this whole enterprise would be effected, and effected it was.
Now,
I was effected out of the place.
Yeah, at this stage you had spent over $1 million buying the island. You had invested several million more. I read somewhere a suggestion that it may have been around €9 million. So would you have
I've no idea where the €9 million came from. I've always said it's 15. Nobody ever seems to listen. You're welcome to quote it. I don't mind.
But
you know, the whole thing cost about €15 million to do. And it was obviously a huge investment.
And the bank was no longer comfortable with the entire setup, really, and they decided to move on you. Did they give you an opportunity to put more money into the venture, or were you behind in repayments?
I think the important thing to reiterate, to be honest, is that it wasn't really the business. It was Ireland. And it was the euro. And you know, I think it's an important point that Inishturk Beg, in a funny sense, was a microcosm of Ireland. You know, it was a little island off a bigger island, but both islands were faced with punitive banks that shafted us. And that's the simple reality of it.
How did you feel about receivers being appointed and losing control of this island when you had not only put €15 million into it, but a lot of your own time and emotion?
Mainly, I was shocked. I had never faced commercial failure before. On top of that, it was a very dear personal asset. Something important to my family and to me personally. So I was deeply horrified, and it was traumatic. However, I've always had, and I think it may be a consequence of the way I was brought up around the world and that I was constantly moving and, you know, environments changed around me. It was not unfamiliar for me to think that I had to find a new compass point on the horizon and head for it. So that's what I did. You know, I thought, okay. With great horror and a great deal of anger, I will nevertheless shut my trap and get on with making some more money, because that's what's needed right now.
If you look back now at the situation as it developed, the bank clearly was unhappy. do you feel a sense that you had been too ambitious, that you may have gone too far in what your borrowings were relative to when this, as a business, was going to make a return and pay the bank back their money?
No, and I think, you know, you've asked a similar question a number of times now, and the point that I would make is that I was not overextended. The businesses were doing well. We had a very successful whiskey launched. We had been through food launches. We had a fabulous music project and product ready to go that had already got to number one on the world music charts. Everything was hunky-dory. The reality was that the bank wanted out of Ireland. It's not really an Inishtoke Beg story. It's an Ireland story. And I remember speaking to our esteemed leader on the phone one day about it, and I said the same thing. I said, look, I'm being shafted, but it's for you too. You know, this is a major national identity crisis.
This is Enda Kenny, know? Was it? A Mayo man, of course.
A Mayo man. That's all I'll say.
And what was his reaction?
I think that should remain private. It was a private conversation.
So the island was then went into receivership. It was then sold. Were there other outstanding debts or other creditors, or did you have to deal with
no,
any of those?
There wasn't a single unpaid supplier in Ireland at all. You know, everything that I had commissioned and done, I honoured and paid.
So you then decided, as you alluded to there, to say, well, I'm going to go back and make some money again, essentially, and that's what you did. You set up a new business.
Yes, I've set up a brand marketing consultancy called Transgressive X, which, I don't know, I spent about a year with some brainy people that I knew that I'd come across in business, and I said, look, if we're to disrupt the category of marketing services and make it really special, you know, rather than just kind of coming up with a Me Too reiteration of what I might have done before, what would we do? And we thought through a lot of things and came up with some new intellectual capital and properties. And it's taken about 18 months to kind of get traction with that. But we've just begun to do really well. We've been commissioned by one of the world's biggest brand owners. We've got hundreds of brands across hundreds of countries. Well, not hundreds, but certainly tens of countries. And it's being adopted as a standard system by them and others. And it's exhilarating, really, that one can create out of loss.
Has your experience with Inishtark Beg affected or changed your views about Ireland and how you feel about the place?
I have, to be honest, always had a degree of ambivalence about Ireland. I love it profoundly. I love its creativity. But I regret its insularity, its isolation, its introspection. You know, what we've often called the begrudgery of Ireland is a painful, painful phenomenon, and it's so unnecessary. But I sometimes refer to Ireland as a swamp. You know, it's a place that has a very kind of rich, fertile soil, and from that comes fabulous creativity. And there's something about the swamp that allows that. On the other hand, the swamp gets you stuck, and you know, you carry it with you everywhere. And sometimes people just can't shake off the stickiness of it all, and they kind of trudge around and all seem to just kind of be pulled back into it. And that I regret. That's the introspection. That's the kind of begrudgery that I really don't appreciate.
Do you come back to Ireland at all, and would you ever envisage moving back here?
I do come back to Ireland. I have a lot of family in Limerick who I don't see often enough. I have connections, of course, in Dublin as well. And some of the dearest people in my life, you know, are in Dublin and also flit between Dublin and London. So I do come back, but...
Have you gone to Clue Bay, Nadine?
I haven't been back to Clue Bay since I left it. No, I haven't.
Something you don't want to do, I presume.
No, it is something I do want to do, but I'll do it on my own terms. And there's a big dot, dot, dot at the end of that.
Okay, Nadim Sadek, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Pleasure.